Welcome to Adventures in Theater History. Here on this show, we bring you the best stories from the deep and fascinating history of theater in the city of Philadelphia. I'm Peter Schmetz, and our sound engineering and original theme music are by Christopher Mark Colucci. On this episode, we continue our series about the history of public controversy on the Philadelphia stage. In the overall storyline, we have reached the 1960s, an era in which the cultural leadership of every major American city, it seemed, was suddenly leading a campaign to found a major nonprofit repertory theater company, and that included Philadelphia. In Philly, the very first entry into this field was called the Theater of the Living Arts. Now, that building is still there on South Street, and most Philadelphians know it as a concert venue. If you're of a certain age, you know it as the place where you first saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show and maybe dressed up to go see it back in the 1970s. But most people, even today, don't know that for a brief moment, that building was the home to one of the most exciting and promising theater companies in the United States. Now, how that amazing phenomenon happened and why everything went wrong is what we aim to examine. Now, let me say two things right up front. First, that this is going to be a two-episode story. So part one today will set the scene and talk about the creation of the Theater of the Living Arts. And then we'll have part two in a few weeks, which will contain the climactic events. Here's the other thing. As we enter into these more recent years of Philadelphia theater history, I know to some people 60 years ago may not seem like recent, but in terms of history, that's pretty recent. Forgive me if I tread a little more lightly in playing up the drama and conflict angle of things. For this show in particular, I'm going to skip the drama is conflict intro theme music. Just want to bring down the temperature a little bit. After all, many of the major participants in this story that we're going to examine today are still alive. Certainly a lot of their family members are. I know because I've talked with quite a number of them recently. And I'm not here to settle scores or to pass some sort of overall judgment. Sure, I have my thoughts on how things turned out. I have opinions, and I'll talk about them, but I'm not going to open up old wounds or poke sore spots or bring back to life quietly smoldering embers of unfinished business. You'd be surprised how long the memories and how deeply rooted grudges in the theater world can be. Or if you're already part of the local nonprofit theater in your part of the world, maybe you're not surprised at all. The fights in the nonprofit theater are so big, perhaps, because, as the old joke goes, the stakes are so small. Sometimes it feels like we're all just battling over a tiny little piece of turf, you know, like those guys in that show. Leonard Bernstein's new musical, West Side Story, came to Philadelphia in September of 1957. Pre-show publicity had built up theatergoers' expectations, and the two-week tryout engagement was sold out even before the first performance. This was a big deal for Philadelphians who followed Broadway news as avidly as anybody else in the country, maybe even more so, because they knew every major Broadway show came through Philly. It was sort of a local privilege. There was almost no major locally produced high-quality professional shows in the city, and for most folks, going to the theater meant attending the large houses in the city, which regularly hosted tryout runs, the Walnut, the Schubert, the Locust, the Forest, or, in this case, the huge and sumptuous Erlanger Theater at the corner of 21st and Market. Now, as it had in its previous stop in Washington, D.C., West Side Story received rapturous reviews from Philadelphia critics. "This is a grown-up musical, topical in theme and classic in form," wrote Henry Murdoch of The Inquirer. It matches grimness, irony, brutality with tender love. It mixes gutter language with poetic speech, rock and roll beats with symphonic surges. However, the show reminded many of the Philadelphia audience members of crime and turmoil in their own struggling neighborhoods, and they proved to be a little leery of its story, which depicted urban violence and, you know, racial tensions. Some people, although they don't want to admit it today, actually left West Side Story at intermission. They didn't see a classic musical in the making. They saw nothing but trouble.
Never mind getting dandelions pulled or the screen door patched or the beach tank pounded. Never mind pumping any water.
In fact, thoughts about West Side Story lingered in Philadelphians' minds in November of 1957, when Meredith Willson's new show, The Music Man, came to the Schubert Theater on Broad Street for its tryout engagement. Now this time, both the critical and the general audience response was overwhelmingly positive. Music Man, after all, was a show about the quirks and the virtues of an entirely white small-town pre-First World War America. It was not set in the troubled, ethnically mixed city of New York, of West Side Story. Quote, "For those theatergoers who think twice about going to a modern musical these days, fearing the New York showmakers are going to offer them the black hole of Calcutta, or perhaps Murder Incorporated in song and dance guise," wrote the Evening Bulletin's Wayne Robinson, "The Music Man offers no stabbings and no gang fights.
Right here in River City. Gotta figure out a way to keep the young ones moral after school.
Our children gonna have trouble."
Note there the phrase, New York showmakers. Now that was perhaps unnecessary, for nobody in Philadelphia expected that major commercial productions would have been created by theater professionals in their own city. Now, as we've seen in recent episodes, even the summer shows of the city-owned Playhouse in the Park largely drew its plays and its casts from New York. Audiences of Philadelphia suburbanites streamed in and out of the city to see the commercial Broadway productions that drove interest in the theater. Now, what about the artistic energy that was building off-Broadway, the smaller, edgier, poetic, and socially relevant shows? Well, during the 1950s, even artistically driven off-Broadway plays were being imported to Philadelphia. For a year or so, you know, the fledgling Circle in the Square company came down from New York and built a thrust theater space in the foyer of the old Academy of Music. Now, when they left that space, Jasper Dieter's ensemble of actors at the Hedgerow Theater out in Chester County took over the Academy space until that venture, too, went badly and it was abandoned. There just didn't seem to be the ability to do serious theater in Philadelphia. Now, there was a lot of homegrown talent in town, as we know. That had always been coming out of Philly's local high schools and its theater training programs and its colleges. But on the whole, young dancers, actors, directors, and playwrights from Philadelphia, they might get their initial start in their hometown, but inevitably they would leave for New York or Los Angeles to make real professional careers for themselves. For a host of reasons, it seemed unlikely that Philly would ever have a vibrant core of resident theater artists itself. Well, hold on. Of course, there was some real cultural excitement in town. Everybody knew about South Street.
Where do all the hippies meet? South Street, South Street. Where the dancing is elite. South Street, South Street.
Even as early as the 1920s, the bars, cabarets, nightclubs, and theaters along South Street had been known as a place where different races could meet and mix as they saw it, as folks sought entertainment. As musicians of that era would say, it was a hip neighborhood. And even as late as 1963, South Street, a song by a black West Philadelphia doo-wop group named the Orlons, became a hit, even reached the third spot on the Billboard Top 10 that year. By the way, this was the song that first used the term hippie, a term that would expand in meaning till it became one of the most consequential words of the decade.
Everybody gather round, nothing big that crazy.
although the black population of the city core was growing and the entire metropolitan area was increasing, since the year 1950, the overall population of the city of Philadelphia had begun to flatten and slowly decrease, and then rapidly decrease. Eventually, it would fall by almost 25%. And as its old neighborhoods struggled to keep their residents, especially their white middle-class residents, we can see from the reaction to shows like West Side Story that crime, or rather the perception of crime sometimes, and racial fears and resentments and prejudices often drove white people away, out to the suburbs where the green lawns and the affordable mortgage rates, for them anyway, beckoned. And to a certain extent, this went for the white working class, too. As the industrial base of the city's economy was leaving Philly, so were its skilled laborers. Few people actually lived in Center City, the principal business district, the old Central Core. We don't call it downtown in Philly. We call it Center City. Particularly hard hit in the mid-century economic decline was the South Street area, that hip and happening place. The city blocks along the bottom of Philadelphia's original city grid, stretching from the Delaware River from the east to the Schuylkill River on the west. If you remember all the way back to our episode 2, this was where the old Southwark Theater once stood, when it was called Cedar Street. But the entire length of South Street had a particular problem: growing dominance of automobiles. And the spreading network of American highways made large cities like Philadelphia eager to sacrifice huge portions of their urban fabric and offer them up to the dictates of progress. Indeed, as the writer Adam Gopnik notes in a recent piece I was just reading in the New Yorker magazine, since the very beginning of the 20th century, Philadelphia had extravagantly torn down its own neighborhoods to build parkways and boulevards and expressways, all to serve the needs of the automobile. Many of the city's theaters, I might note, had been torn down and replaced by parking lots. Now, even though Philadelphia was still well served by commuter rail lines, after World War II, its trolley lines were mostly dismantled, and suddenly there were parcels of federal highway money available to build roads. It's a well-known story by now. In those post-war years, American mayors and city councils hastened to use all that money to clear slums and create urban renewal by building even more highways and high-rises. Following the advice of city planner Edmund Bacon, Mayor Dilworth allowed the construction of the Schuylkill Expressway right through West Fairmount Park. And Highway 95 was soon being built between the city and the Delaware River to the east. Now, to join these two behemoth roads, two enormous parallel expressways had been announced that would bring auto and truck traffic from one side to the other. Now, the Northern Expressway would be called the Vine Street Expressway, plowing through the old Tenderloin District and the Chinatown neighborhoods, requiring the demolition of all the buildings and houses that were in its path. Now, that project would be completed, and it exists, roaring through a huge trench on the north side of Center City to this day. Its proposed counterpart, the Crosstown Expressway, would obliterate South Street and all the blocks around it. Now, I'll put maps of what I'm describing here on the podcast website. You look for the link in our show notes, or if you yourself are driving right now, as you possibly are, wait till you get home. Real estate values plummeted. Many of South Street's longtime residents, faced with this imminent destruction, just left the South Street area, selling their houses at a considerable loss. But others stayed and fought long and hard against the proposed project in the courts and in other public forums. As this dispute continued, year after year, rents and real estate prices in the South Street area stayed low. This was hard on people who couldn't get their money out of their buildings and had nowhere to go, but it did have the effect of making the area an attractive haven for, well, bohemians, you know, writers and artists, musicians, people who were willing to live on less money if they could instead do their thing, follow their dreams, make their art, And because of these people, there were even the first green shoots of a new local theater scene, too. Dean and Jay Cogan had started the mostly amateur group, the Society Hill Playhouse, in tiny old Garrick Hall on 8th Street, and the area welcomed them in an era when other Philadelphia neighborhoods were experiencing these rising social and racial tensions. Here in this part of town, they found a relaxed and inviting mixture of cultures. After all, it was where all the hippies meet. And that was why four Philadelphians thought that this part of town would be the perfect place for a professional resident theater company. These four Philadelphians were two married couples, Frederick and Jean Goldman, and Louis and Celia Silverman. Now, when I say they were Philadelphians, I mean that in the wider sense of the word, because they and their families did not live within the city limits, they were out in the city's gracious northern suburbs. The Silvermans lived in Wincote, and the Goldmans lived in Elkins Park. Neither of them were from big money, not by any means. Fred Goldman ran a small advertising firm, and Louis Silverman was a real estate investor. Their wives, Jean and Celia, had met 10 years previously while acting in shows at the Cheltenham Playhouse, the local community theater, and they had quickly bonded over their mutual love of theater and because of their common former lives as serious students of acting. Celia, originally from Pittsburgh, had studied at the Hedgerow Theater School with Jasper Dieter and Rose Shulman. And Jean, originally from Illinois, had spent time in New York in her younger days, studying with Stella Adler and Herbert Berghoff. Now, of course, they were both housewives and mothers in the parlance of that time, but they longed to do consequential work for their community in their area of expertise. Of course, why wouldn't they? In 1961, the two women produced Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit at the Hedgerow Theater. They followed that up the next season with Bertolt Brecht's The Private Life of the Master Race. Now, both these shows were a success, and Goldman and Silverman found that they were really good at this. They liked it. But why stay at the amateur and semi-professional level, they thought? Why not take the next step and start a resident professional theater company in Philadelphia? Because in that era of American history, well, it really was women who were doing a lot of the most consequential work in getting new theater companies started, outside of New York, at least, in what was then termed the regions. Nina Vance at the Alley Theater in Houston, Margot Jones at Dallas Theater Center, Mary Widrick John at the Milwaukee Rep. They were early leaders in the field. And closer by to Philly, there was the example of Zelda Fitchhandler at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., who, along with her husband Tom, had started a theater company in an old abandoned movie theater back in 1950. And now, in the early 60s, she was one of the great, shiny examples of a serious theater artist and producer, directing plays by the giants of world literature, organizing her own company. Zelda and all of these women had spent endless hours raising money, transforming older buildings into new and innovative thrust and in-the-round spaces. They were creating a stable base of subscribers. It was a heady time. And because of recent changes to the U.S. tax code, starting a theater no longer required sucking up to wealthy benefactors to bankroll these ambitions. Now you could incorporate under Rule 501c3 as a non-profit corporation. You could collect tax-deductible donations from donors, small and large, and you didn't have to turn a profit each year. You just had to break even and slowly, hopefully, expand. By 1961, the Ford Foundation had also helped to start TCG, the Theater Communications Group, to help coordinate amongst all these new regional theater companies. At that point, there were 23 regional theaters in the United States. So, thought the Goldmans and the Silvermans, why not Philadelphia? The time was ripe. And instead of starting a theater company out in the suburbs, as happened in some cities, they wanted to do something central, right in the heart of town. Because after all, this, they knew, was where all the deep history of theater in Philadelphia was. There was a lot of interest during that time in the late 18th century because Philadelphia, rightly or wrongly, I think wrongly, but let's leave that aside, was clearing away a lot of old 19th century buildings to better reveal all the bones of its federal period. A festival in 1960 had even organized a tour of all the places in the city where vibrant theater had once taken place and maybe could take place again. Now, to their credit, the women's two husbands, Lewis and Frederick, were completely on board and supportive of this idea. Even though they didn't have a lot of money, they had some. They could do something. Lewis Silverman, with his real estate expertise, quickly located for them an abandoned old movie theater, the Model Theater, it was called, at 334 South Street. Sure, there was no stage in it, and there were a lot of holes in the roof and toadstools growing out of its moldy carpets, but there was a high roofline, there was salvageable film projectors in the balcony, and there was room to build offices and backstage facilities. In December 1963, the deal was made for a down payment of $5,000. The Goldmans and the Silvermans used their own money, along with small contributions from their friends, the musician Anthony Chekia and the accountant Howard Berkowitz. Later, they also bought a small storefront next door for future additional lobby space, as well as an adjoining warehouse to the rear for more backstage facilities. Their friend, local architect Frank Weiss, volunteered his services and created a 430-seat auditorium with a thrust stage. Now, eventually, when all the remodeling was done, they had invested almost $60,000. The Goldmans put a mortgage on their own house to raise the needed funds. But they had it. They had a space. And now came the even more challenging part: building public support and finding the staff and the artists. And most of all, they had to convince Philadelphians to come down to the dowdy old South Street area where there was almost no parking and there was not stops for trains or subways. It was a long way from the old established theater district. There was plenty of skepticism. "We were told it couldn't be done," recalled Celia Silverman, "that Philadelphia was a tryout town which wouldn't support a permanent theatrical company. But we went ahead." They even had a new name for the place. It would be an institution where the deadwood and the detritus of the past would be cleared out, and where, right in the old rich ground of historic Philadelphia, brand new theater, dance, music, and cinema could all flourish and grow. They would call it the Theater of the Living Arts. March of 1964, the Fearless Foursome had founded a new nonprofit arts umbrella organization called the Philadelphia Council for the Performing Arts. A board of trustees was assembled for it. They staged a community dialogue at a hotel in Center City, which brought a lot of publicity, and they used it not to solicit funds, but to gather ideas and create buzz and excitement. 400 of the cultural and business leaders of the city turned up. You know, it was all coming together, amazingly. "The response was so enthusiastic," said Joan Goldman later, "that we felt like Balboa when he first gazed upon Darien. Still, we had to go out and sell." And sell they did. They followed up on that big meeting with hundreds of daily smaller meetings, coffee parties, organizational conferences, and cocktail parties. They spoke on TV and the radio. They went to New York to gather the rights for the plays and the playwrights. They told everybody they wanted to produce. Brecht, Moliere, Eugene O'Neill. The next step was they needed an artistic leadership. Some great theater director. Someone who would be the public face of the organization. Who would be charming and sociable and could help with fundraising and with long-term planning. And quickly, there was an answer to that question too. A Harvard graduate in his early 30s who had significantly a deep education and experience in modern theater. He had worked at the Berliner Ensemble in Germany itself. He had been a member of the Actors Studio in New York, and he was just coming from a stint helping to start the first year of Seattle Rep. And even though he had no particular ties to Philadelphia, Andre Gregory seemed like a great match for the Theater of the Living Arts. Now, how exactly did the TLA, and Gregory find each other? I'm not sure. In his recently published book, written with Todd London, entitled This Is Not My Memoir, cheekily, Andre Gregory's a little cagey about the whole thing. Now, personally, I find this book, which is, of course, in fact, a memoir, just delightful. I'm fascinated by his whole life story. You should take a look at it. I really highly recommend it. But as is the case with many memoirs, I gotta say, we should be careful on relying on it for factual accuracy. According to the book, Andre Gregory asked the famous director, Alan Schneider, for advice on how he could also become a great director. Schneider told him, by the way, to create his own theater, one outside of New York. Here's the quote. At that time, wrote Gregory, there were very few regional theaters across the country. I bought myself a large map of America, put it up on the wall, pinned a red flag in each good city that already had a theater, a blue flag in lousy cities, and a gold flag in excellent cities with no theater. I came up with Philadelphia. Close quotes. Gregory then states that he called his friend Malcolm Eisenberg, a socially well-connected Philadelphia interior designer, and got him to throw parties and to invite important Philadelphians and let him then show up and talk about his ideas for a new theater. Again, quoting Gregory, over 2 years, I talked at nearly 200 events. I managed to line up 8,000 subscribers to support a theater that did not exist. Thus, the Theater of Living Arts was born. Close quotes. Well, that theater did already exist. We've established that. A few other obvious factual errors stand out in this account, too, because the book immediately mixes up the repertoires of the first and second seasons of that theater. But putting that aside, most glaringly, Gregory and London entirely leave out any mention at all of the Goldmans and the Silvermans when describing the creation of the TLA. So, I don't know what to say. Except, well, I guess we all have a narrative of our own life story that maybe favors ourselves a little, especially 60 years on. And clearly, in the book, Gregory doesn't want to dwell too long on this Philly period of his life. He's got a lot more of his fascinating life story still to go, and maybe a lot of his readers aren't going to care too much about what happened in Philly in the 60s anyway. So maybe he just cuts a few corners in this part of the narrative just to speed things along. I might speculate that the truth may likely be that Gregory did decide in the early 1964 that he wanted to go to Philadelphia to make a theater. But he quickly learned that there was a great local project already up and running, and that was looking for an artistic director, amazingly. And so, through his connections, he got himself mentioned as the obvious candidate, and he met people, and he was in the right place at the right time. The board of PCPA did approach other people. At first, they tried to recruit huge name directors like Elia Kazan and Harold Klerman. But when those eminences proved not to be interested in going to Philly, the board realized they had to go with someone maybe a little earlier in their career. So why not turn to this young phenom, this guy who was wildly signaling already that he wanted the job? His resume was sparkling, and so was his smile. Really, he was, by all measures, quite a find. Dapper, sociable, brilliant, compassionate, Andre Gregory was and is amazingly handsome and eloquent and photogenic. Just watch him in the famous movie My Dinner with Andre, and you can see what I mean. In a newspaper photo of the public announcement of his appointment at the Barclay Hotel in Philadelphia on May 10th, 1964, we can see Gregory at the podium, smiling that great smile of his. And to his side is our old friend, Philadelphia Mayor James Tate, looking up at Gregory approvingly. Now, clearly, Tate was thrilled about this new independently run resident theater project. This was not the gritty details of a little summer theater run by the Fairmount Park Commission. This was the sort of prestige project that every local politician wants to boast about in his city. If it goes well, of course. But, you know, in the end, he doesn't have to take responsibility for it if it does not. So Andre Gregory was booked. He soon moved his family to Philadelphia, and he took the reins at the Theater of the Living Arts. On the whole, he approved of the choice of repertoire that had already been decided on, but he did suggest that maybe while Galileo and Misanthrope and Tiger of the Gates were great, fine, maybe they should round out the season with Beckett's Endgame, which was agreed to by all. And now, the assembling of the acting company and the audience could begin. Throughout that summer of 1964 and into the fall, there was much work to be done on selling subscriptions and fundraising. There were no blockbuster donors for the theater. Nobody parishooting in with $500,000. But there was a pleasing variety to their sources. The very wealthy Pugh family of the Sun Oil fortune gave them $500. But so did Sam Ospitz, the owner of the delicatessen at 4th and Bainbridge. There were endless letters to be typed up by volunteers to get these donations, asking for supports. And these were typed up one by one, amazingly, in that age before mail merge programs and email blasts existed. And they were all sent off in envelope after envelope, the congregation lists of synagogues, the mailing list of the Devon Horse Show, the membership list of the Philadelphia Art Museum. They all got their letters. And fundraising parties were held, at which Anthony Cecchia would bring along young musicians from the Curtis School of Music to perform for prospective subscribers and members. It was all part of the gestalt of this new theater, this home for the living arts. Indeed, a series of concerts called Music from Marlborough was built right into the season, it was announced. Then, at these parties, inevitably, Andre Gregory would come out with his soft sell. "Isn't it amazing," he would ask, that Oklahoma City has a resident theater, but Philadelphia doesn't? Can we let this be?" Fred Goldman would then follow up with the hard pitch. "Subscribe now, become a member, here's the form." And slowly but surely this worked. The money came in. 1,000 memberships were pledged, and over 7,000 season subscriptions were sold. A support staff and a crew of 18 was hired, and a budget of $250,000 was made by their new business manager, David Lunny. Celia Silverman and Gene Goldman, working tirelessly all the time, were the theater's joint producers, but for the moment, they took no salary. Meanwhile, a resident cast of 10 actors was hired after a long series of auditions in New York and Philadelphia. Andre Gregory had always been very respectful of actors, very interested in their process, and he was clear that he wanted a true resident company, one that would develop a group ethos, but nonetheless composed of eloquent individuals with strong improvisation skills. Of the people that were engaged, perhaps inevitably, many came from the Actors Studio in New York. Now, these were real major actors with good credits on TV and film and with promising futures in the theater. People like Lois Smith, Ron Liebman, Tom Branham, Anthony Zerba, and David Hurst. There were a few Philadelphia actors in the mix. A beautiful young Sally Kirkland, in fact, was from a very well-established old Quaker City family. Miriam Phillips was from the Hedgerow Theater, but all of them had to agree to the initial salary, which, under the contract negotiated with Actors Equity, was pretty paltry, even for them, just $150 a week, with a promise of eventually becoming $300 a week. But the work in the shows promised to be exciting, and the possibilities of a more prosperous future seemed bright. They could even earn extra money from teaching at the theater's new training school, which began accepting eager students from around the community. The actors even called themselves the Southwark Company, after the original theater that had once just stood a few blocks away in the late 18th century. That was where President George Washington would come to see plays presented by Thomas Wignell. That was the very first story of our very first episode, remember? I'm suddenly a bit nostalgic and I'm going to tear up just a little bit. Okay, moving on. Actual rehearsals for the Theater of the Living Arts Company did not start until December of 1964, however. And the company was at that point joined by one new member, 8-year-old Adam Gopnik, in the role of the boy. Adam Gopnik was the son of two local Philadelphia academics, and little Adam, of course, would later grow up to become the acclaimed staff writer on the New Yorker magazine, the author of that article about cars and highways that I mentioned earlier, and so much else. Just an amazing fact, isn't it? I was pretty much bowled over when I first learned that. Let's all claim his amazing talent and erudition as a result of his early exposure to theater in Philadelphia. Surely that must be it. Absolutely. The opening night of Brecht's Galileo was scheduled for the first week in January 1965. As might be expected, though, a lot of preparation work had been done. Some things were still a little chaotic. The Stagehands Union, for example, threatened to picket the opening night, demanding that its union members be put on the crew. And they called off the labor action only a few hours before curtain. And at the very last minute, the city fire inspector showed up and pointed out there were no fire extinguishers in the building. Gotta close you down. And so Fred Goldman had to rush out immediately to buy some fire extinguishers in his evening clothes. Finishing touches to the theater's marquee were being made by workers on ladders while the audience walked into the lobby underneath them. And it turned out that due to the rather short rehearsal period and Andre Gregory's direction, which was working so hard to replicate the work of the Berliner Ensemble on the same text that he knew so well, this had brought the show's running time to an astounding length. The first preview ran for 4 hours, 1 hour more than everyone expected. And on top of everything else, there were no mirrors in the dressing room for everyone to make their numerous costume changes. But, you know, at the end, everything turned out okay. That's the way things happen in the theater. It's a mystery, as we know, but there it is. 1 week later, at the official press opening, the running time of the show was down to just 3.5 hours, and afterwards, the audiences were enthusiastic, and the local reviewers were really intrigued and full of praise. A little guarded, true. They didn't know quite what they had here yet, but still, there was definite optimism. It was what was suddenly on their assigned docket of reviewing duties for the foreseeable future. Proclaimed Ernest Shire in the bulletin, Philadelphia's newest adventure in theater has begun auspiciously. And yep, when I read that a few years ago, that's where I got the name for this whole podcast. He also praised Wolfgang Roth's lighting and design for the show. The Enquirer's Henry Murdoch especially marveled at the large and talented band of actors in the company that were suddenly resident in his community. He also deeply admired, in his review, what he called Andre Gregory's freewheeling stagecraft. The action took place in side stages and lofts and up and down the aisles of the theater. Quote, "For this production, the Theater of Living Arts escapes the proscenium limitations and obeys the modern concept that for the best communication, the players are in the lap of the audience, and vice versa." Close quotes. Even Adam Gopnik, when interviewed years later, could remember clearly Gregory's staging, because evidently the entire Gopnik clan of kids got enlisted in the show as well. Quote, "He was doing Brechtian theater with an American sense of spectacle that was astonishing for people to see. Galileo was meant by Brecht to be a teaching piece, highly intellectual. That's the sense of his epic theater. Andre did that, but his natural bent was for the spectacular, so that in scene 10 of the play, he felt it was weak in life, and so he had all my brothers and sisters come in to be ragamuffins on the stage. He liked the sense of the extreme, the melodramatic." And even TLA founder Fred Goldman, who would later turn into a dedicated and remorseless foe of Andre Gregory, spoiler alert, for the moment, he was pleased. "Critical and audience response was excellent. Single ticket sales accelerated for the following weeks and the following plays. Laudatory articles appeared in the New York Times, the New Republic, the Saturday Review, and numerous theater journals. The inaugural season was lauded and fiscally sound. And so, we'll leave it there with this venture, lauded and fiscally sound and well and truly launched. We'll be back next time with the second half of this story when things start to take a decidedly different turn, culminating in the infamous production of the play, Bechlech. Much excitement to come, ladies and gentlemen. It wouldn't be a Philadelphia theater story without it. No riots this time, true, but I can promise you magnificent African dancers, exposed body parts, goats being sacrificed on stage, cockfights, lawsuits, boardroom battles, firings, police intervention, and lots, lots more. That's our show. I want to thank the librarians and the staff of the Special Research Collection at the Temple University Library and the folks at the Pennsylvania Historical Society for all their professional assistance in uncovering documents and archival material for these episodes. And my deepest appreciation to Gail Cohen for compiling those archives and for all her advice and help. Special thanks to Karen Sooney at the Theater Collection of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Really, she's just amazingly helpful. Everyone else, please write to us. Our email is aithpodcast@gmail.com, or you can contact us right on our website, www.aithpodcast.com. In the show notes to this episode, you can find the link to our Patreon account. In return for just a little support from you, there's all sorts of extra information and additional material there. So, you know, sign up. Find out all about it. We appreciate your support. Thank you, everyone, for listening today and for coming along on yet another adventure in theater history. Philadelphia.